Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Thursday, September 26th, my dad's birthday. Happy birthday, Dad. And I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our newly redesigned website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in today to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg candlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea. Technology you can trust. Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com. Do you provide a heat source for your backyard chickens in the winter? In most cases, it's not necessary. But if you choose to provide a heat source for your backyard chickens, it's imperative to use a safe and effective heat source, and the only one I recommend is the Sweeter Heater. The Sweeter Heater is a safe, completely sealed, washable, non-breakable, energy-efficient, long-lasting, and reliable specific area heater that comes with a 3-year warranty. Ditch the dangerous heat lamp this season and invest in the only heater I recommend, the Sweeter Heater. Purchase the Sweeter Heater online at sweeterheater.com. That's sweeterheater.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We've got a great show lined up for you today. It is the fourth Thursday of the month, which means we've got Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, that's going to be on talking all about making mead and also other ancient, if you will, concoctions and drinks. So it's going to be a very interesting show. Get those Chicken Whisperer notebooks out. Get ready to take a lot of notes. We love it when Richard on. He is our homesteading expert, if you will, and he comes on the second and fourth Thursday of every month. We've had some great topics all this week. Monday with the chicken doctor, Peter Brown, and then yesterday, all about quail with Alexander Douglas. Today, we're talking about making mead on our homestead show with Back Home Magazine, and looking forward to next week's shows as well. So we thank you very much for tuning in. Want to send a real quick shout out, as I always do, to the homeschoolers that listen to this radio show and incorporate it into their daily curriculum. We thank you very much for tuning in. All the over-the-road truck drivers we hear from, keep the rubber on the road, get that freight there safely, and yourself too. And thanks for listening to the archive 24/7. All the live listeners, all the archive listeners that listen on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes.com, Podcast.com, and Zoom.com, thank you very much. There's thousands of you, and we love every single one of you. And also, last but not least, all the feed and seed stores across the country that stream this radio show live for their customers every day at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Whole business as well, and we thank you for doing so. All righty, so we do have a great show today. And one last shout-out. I got to send a shout-out to Mr. Christmas Chick. Mr. Christmas Chick, it is his birthday today. It is also my father's birthday. We went out last night and celebrated and had supper and got him a gift and a card and whatnot. You hug his neck, tell him I loved him. But it is Mr. Christmas Chick. It is his birthday today. So we want to wish him a very, very, very happy birthday. And let's just, since we don't have chickens clucking birthday, since you do live in Christmas, Florida, and your farm is called Fort Christmas Farm, and your wife is Christmas Chick in the chat room, and we consider you Mr. Christmas Chick, then maybe this will survive. There you go, Christmas Jake. You can play for that. Play that for him just a little bit later. I did post in the chat room that I did have some unfortunate news today. I didn't learn about it until yesterday, and so I wanted to share this with our listeners because I didn't know, and I didn't know if any of our listeners knew, but wanted to let you know that we have a long-time listener. I'm talking about multiple years, regular listener. We have regular listeners that come and go based on their schedule or their work or, you know, having their work eliminate the ability to get in the chat room and things like that. We still hear from them. They still listen live but just can't access the chat room. But one of our longest regular listeners, in fact, I met him when we were on the Purina tour flying all over the country. When we flew out to Texas, we were in Dallas. Many of you know him in the chat room as East Dallas Dave, East Dallas Dave McPherson. Good friend of mine and always in the chat room, always a pleasure in the chat room as well. Funny, funny guy. And I hadn't seen him in the chat room in a while, and I saw him, I'd say, in the last month. And I saw him on Facebook last night. He popped on, and I sent him a message asking him, told him we missed him and if everything was okay. And so we need to all, depending on what your beliefs are, lift him up in prayer, in good thoughts, good vibes, rainbow wishes, whatever you want to do, whatever your form of a belief is. But we need to lift up Dave McPherson and his entire family. Pray for him. But he and his family unexpectedly, just out of the blue, lost their 22-year-old son. He passed away unexpectedly, apparently in his sleep. They're waiting on the cause of death. It's not even on the death certificate yet. They're waiting for it. It could take up to 90 days, and they're just not really sure. But a friend found him. He went to bed and didn't wake up. So 22 years old, taken from us much too soon. And I just found out yesterday talking to my good friend Dave McPherson, East Dallas Dave, in the chat room, who's been a one of our longest regular listeners ever, since we've been doing the show for 5 years broadcasting. So lift Dave and his family up in prayer, and he said he may start tuning in here as he gets back into normal routine. He had to drive out to Michigan to get his parents, drive them back to Texas for the service, and then he was en route back to Texas from dropping them back off after the service. It was this past Saturday, so he's spending a lot of time on the road. I'm sure he has because he is. He's got lots of time to think and get things in order mentally, spiritually, and whatnot. But just definitely keep him in your prayers. I just can't imagine losing, you know, parents always say, no, it's not supposed to happen like that. I'm supposed to go before my kids go. It's just not something that's natural. I shouldn't have to bury my kids. So I've often attempted to post, but I just never have. But about, you know, I was never really, you ask any of my family members, even my wife, I was never really a kid person. You know, it's like, well, if we have them, we have them. You know, maybe one day I'd like to have kids, you know, that type of thing. And me and Jen dated for 4 years before we got married, and they got married, and we're celebrating, actually, in 3 days, this Sunday, the 29th. Well, I've been married for 12 years, and our youngest, Caleb, is 2 years old, so we were married 10 years before we decided to have children, and Jen probably would have had them the first year, and now that I've got two, every day I kind of wish I would have had them a little bit earlier. And I often tell myself, you know, I just never realized that you could love somebody as much as I love my kids and I love my wife and all that's grand, but I just never realized in all my days that you could love a human being as much as you love your kids and how fun they can be. And I guess I was just selfish all those years. But anywho, so I just can't imagine what Dave's going through, especially after raising him and, you know, 22 years old, just not supposed to have them. So send your prayers out to Dave. We would appreciate it. And when you see him in the chat room, whenever he decides to, you know, start joining us again when the time is right, send him a little note of encouragement. Glad to see him. So thank you very much again for tuning in today. We've had some great shows this week, and today's going to be no exception. We've got Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, and he's in queue right now. So we're going to head on over to the switchboard and bring him on. Let's go ahead and give Richard a big chicken whisper of welcome. Hey, Richard, I hope you're doing well, and I hope you're enjoying this kind of cool weather we're having now in the mountains.
Oh, yeah, we're having some very cool weather, yes. It's good to see the seasons change.
It is. It's nice. Fall is beautiful. I don't know which is my favorite, fall or spring, and early spring, you know, March when it starts to really become nice, but or fall, because I love the cooler weather. I'm not a fan of hot weather at all, but watching the leaves change and just the atmosphere of fall, it's just I really like it. It's nice. So I know you being there in the mountains of North Carolina, are really seeing that. We're currently in the mountains of Northeast Georgia, and which we love it up here, enjoying all the fall changing of the weather and looking at the leaves starting to change and fall, and it's just beautiful up here, which I'm sure it is up there as well. So the next thing you know, you'll be coming on, and we'll be talking about how cold it is, and a farmer's almanac, and everybody else, it seems like, all across the internet is claiming for a very harsh winter for everybody. So we'll see if that ends up being true or not, but back down the hatch, as they say, for winter. But I'm glad you joined us today. We've got an interesting topic. I guess about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, Arlena Schott, Garden Wise Living on Wednesdays, she had two shows really all about just wine. In fact, the second show she did, she actually broadcast from a tasting room of a winery up in Wisconsin, and we picked the winery's brain about all different types of procedures of bottling wine and different grapes, the different wines, I mean, everything. It was really a great show. And but we've never had a show on actually making, I guess, homemade wine or mead using, you know, or as you call it, wine honey or honey wine. And I know that I have a niece that often comments when we're together for holidays and things about making mead. And so we're all interested in learning about that, as well as you said in the email today, different types of classic, old-time, historic brews, if you will. So we're ready to learn.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting topic, and obviously one that we can't cover nearly as deeply as you might want to in the time we have. But the reason we are talking about mead instead of wine is that we have had an interest in the magazine. People have had an interest in getting articles on. Seeing an article on mead making, maybe because it's more traditional. Mead is basically a honey-based wine, and it's probably one of the oldest, either the mead or the variants of mead, probably the oldest beverage making techniques around. I mean, it's been around since Old Testament times, and you know, there's references to mead-based or honey-based drinks in you know, in scripture and in medieval times and all that. And there's all sorts of different variants depending on what it's made from and what's added to it. And really, the mead has a little more mystique to it. You know, we chose the fall because it, with a very traditional mead making technique, it can take months, even over a year to make a good traditional mead, but that's not necessary. I mean, you can make some honey wines in a lot less time than that. But just the scheduling of the way magazine articles are done and how we, you know, time things. Mead is also a festive holiday type drink, so to have mead ready for readers by Christmas time or holiday season, we wanted to run this particular article in our September October issue, so people would have time, you know, early September have time to get their stuff together and maybe process it and give it, you know, give it a few weeks or a month or so to process and ferment. So that's why we did that. And in the discussion of mead, there is also a lot of interrelated discussion of wines, but the techniques are very, very similar. So if I go back and forth, or if I use terminology talking about things that, you know, it may be considered a wine in some circles, or it may be a mead, but it's all meat based. I'll just mention a few things. I mean, like I think I even dropped you when I dropped you a note, Andy. I said like Sizer, for example. Sizer is a honey based wine or mead, but it is blended with apple cider, which makes a really nice dry wine. And Sizer is probably one of the oldest referenced beverages ever. I mean, this is what Abraham may have gotten drunk on in Genesis, in the book of Genesis. Really, I'm serious. I mean, they talk about you know, Sizer is just a very very old drink. So there's that. Wow. And there's also Metheglin is like the medieval drink. I mean, maybe the Harry Potter type stuff. I'm not really so sure about that, but it's of that era. You know, this is again a very, very old dry honey based mead, but it's also blended with herbs and spices. And you've got your pine mints and your braggot and your, you know, hypocras, and there's a lot of different things. All these definitions of, you know, some of these are blended piments and spices, and some are beverages made from honey, and then beer-based things like barley and hops and other things, piments, honey, and grape juice. So all these have very historical backgrounds, and the real reason for all this discussion, not necessarily the idea of the alcohol, you know, the alcohol part of it. It's mainly the alcohol involved in the beverage is traditionally has not been to get, you know, to get imbibed and drunk or anything. It's the point is to be able to store excess fruit and keep it from spoiling. And the only way to really do that, you know, like meats and things can be seasoned with salt and processed in other ways, but that wouldn't work. Obviously, putting salt in your grape juice isn't going to work very well for the taste. So the only way to really handle that is to ferment it, and it will store then for quite a long time. And that really was the reason you know, and from olden times even to today, to turn it into wine or alcoholic beverage to begin with. You know, as we know, even with liquor based drinks, the idea was to convert apples and grains into white liquor or some type of liquor based beverage, so we could store it, and you wouldn't have to. They couldn't carry like it locally in these mountains. They couldn't carry bushels of apples down the mountain to sell in the flatland part of the state as easily as they could to bottle it and compact it more or less, and then sell it as a beverage or store it as a beverage. So you know, for medicinal purposes as well as beverages. So all this just gets back to the old, you know, well before refrigeration or the knowledge we have about preservation and storing things, just a natural way of storage. So the mead is just a really old traditional drink, and I think, you know, I need to do a little bit of background. Anything that ferments, anything that rots, can be used to make an alcohol-based beverage. And the easiest stuff to use is stuff that is already sugar. Apples, grapes, currants. You know, anything like that, that peaches, those
oranges,
kind of...
Oranges. And the reason why I giggle a little bit about that was back in the day when I was working full-time as a paramedic for about a decade, we would occasionally run calls over to the city jail, both at Atlanta and the large Fulton County jail. And we would occasionally be there when they were doing, what would they call it? Not sweeps, but anyway, breakdowns, something. And they would go and look for contraband in the different cells and whatnot. And on occasion, they would find that the prisoners there would be making alcoholic beverage, maybe meat, whatever you want to call it, in the toilets. So basically what they would do is like three or four cells would say, okay, we're just going to use my toilet, all four of us in these, or all eight of us are in these four cells. We'll just use this toilet. The other three, they'll clean really good, hopefully. And then they'll actually sneak in or bring in, maybe they were allowed to have fruit, oranges, apples, pears, whatever. And they would actually fill that up, water, what have you, and put all this fruit in there, and it would just ferment in there, trying to make or get their fix on alcohol. So that, I giggle a little bit when we talk about whether making wine or mead or whatever, any type of alcoholic beverage, because it always goes back to that time back in the mid-90s when I would see first introduced to alcohol brewed in prison in toilets because of the fruit they'd bring back from whatever dinners. And ever since then, I just have that picture in my mind walking in that cell and seeing that toilet full of all this fruit concoction. I'm thinking, you know, what in the heck? And, oh, they're making alcohol. We've got to flush it, got to get rid of it, whatever. It's contraband. But they're making alcohol in their jail cell in the toilet with all the fruit rotting and whatnot. So I get a giggle whenever I think about that or talk about fermenting and making wine and alcoholic beverage. So I just wanted to share that with folks. It can be done in a prison in the toilet with all the fruit and stuff that you get from the cafeteria if you ever find yourself there. So,
yeah,
go ahead.
That's actually, you know, as far as our magazine goes, that's true because we have, you know, every state has its own rules regarding prisoners and what they can receive as far as reading material and videos and stuff. And occasionally, I know every time we do an article on anything like making beer, making wine, or making mead, whatever, we can expect to receive a little note back. You know, there's a fair number of incarcerated people with subscriptions to the magazine, and uh-huh. When it is not delivered, you know, we do our part and we mail it. And when it is not received by the prisoner, the prison is obligated to inform us that the magazine has not been delivered as paid for because it has contained something on making weapons or political unrest or making alcohol, whatever. And so I can always expect a little note back from the, you know, Texas or Illinois or wherever it is going, saying your periodical has not been delivered to Mr. Smith's number, blah, 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 because it contains an article on check below, and it'll say manufacturing alcohol. So we don't get the magazine back, but they don't get it either. So I guess the warden reads it. But I know we're going to get a complaint from the prisoner because if I didn't get my magazine, well, you know, he knows why. But anyway, basically can use any kind of a fruit or sugar-based produce to manufacture a wine or a mead or beer. And I guess I should put a little sharper point on that. There is rice wine. Rice is not a sweet produce. Rice is a starch. And there are other wines made out of fruits and vegetables that are not, like potatoes, for example. Well, it's not a wine, but one can ferment from a starch-based product like potatoes or rice or anything else, but that requires an extra step to break the starches into sugars and then work on the sugars. Well, it's much easier to start with sugar to begin with, and also the wines, generally the wine-type beverages that are made from fruits are taste better than, or taste a lot different, they're sweeter than beverages made from starches. So we're just going to talk about using fruits and really for the most part honey to discuss this mead today. You can do it at home. It doesn't take a long time really. You do need some basic equipment. I would suggest going online first, or getting a subscription, or just getting a back issue of the magazine, or just getting a pamphlet or a little book from a brewer's supply or a wine and beer supply house, or just some basic background in home brewing and winemaking to just read up on it to begin with. But you will need something like that, just some general instructions, which I'm going to go over today anyway. But and then you need some basic equipment, which is going to be a 5-gallon bucket or food grade container with a lid on it. You'll need an airlock and a stopper. An airlock is a bubbling device that basically is a cap that has a little vent. It's a vent really with a container built into it that allows water to be put in there. And what that does is it allows gas to escape the fermenting chamber, but does not allow air to come back in. The water in the airlock is there to seal the airlock so that air can get out, or gas can get out, but air cannot come back in. So that's called an airlock. You'll probably need a carboy or some type of 5-gallon glass or plastic container that can be cleaned and sanitized. You will need some cheesecloth for straining, because there's going to be bits of fruit and pieces of whatever you use, the fruits or whatever, to strain out. Probably a funnel, some kind of food-grade funnel, usually plastic funnel. A thermometer, a candy thermometer, or some type of brewer's thermometer. Some of these are quite cheap. They're not. You can get a dial thermometer for probably $19, but you don't even need that. They make heat-sensitive gel thermometers that have they're basically just fluid thermometers in little plastic on sheets with color coordinated, or some of them have little temperature things on the side, but you can pretty much get them for really just a few dollars, or you can go spend $20 and get a dial thermometer. And you'll need something to a racking cane is another thing. That's like a tube that will allow you to insert and extract the fermented liquid from the bottom of the container instead of from the top, because the top's going to have a lot of sediment in it. So you want to stick it down at the bottom and be able to extract the fluid from the bottom without disturbing the working fermenting material. And you'll need some type of, well, obviously you need bottles and corks and all that. You'll want to also get a sanitizer of some type, and that's, I can talk about that a little bit later on, but that's basically one of the most important things is to clean your equipment, make sure it's absolutely clean. And you'll also want to get some yeast, some wine-type yeast, winemaker's yeast, which is, there's a lot of different varieties of yeast, but a lot of serious homebrewers, you know, either cultivate their own yeast or they are very specific in what they buy, but you can just get a very simple, basic winemaker's yeast that will tolerate quite a bit of alcohol level. The problem with yeast is that when it gets above a certain alcohol level percentage, some yeast can't live above like 10% alcohol, and many are blended to live and thrive actually in at levels of a little over 20%. So you want a good wine one, maybe allows yeast to live at 15% or so, and these are available at any co-op or winemaking store or whatever. And the sanitizers are generally stuff. There's a product called Be Bright, capital B-B-R-I-T, and there's a whole bunch of other ones a lot like that. I don't know the names of all the particular cleaning agents, but there's any beer making store or wine making store has them. There's two or three very very popular ones, Be Bright or Santa Bright or whatever, and that'll be obvious when you if you go online you can look for those. And there's also other more time-honored methods. I mean, you can clean equipment with bleach, which some people do it, but I don't recommend it. It can leave an aftertaste, even if you think you've cleaned it quite well. Not pure bleach, but bleach mixed with water. Even then, it will kill the germs, but it still has a bit of a aftertaste. And also, it has the risk of killing germs killing microorganisms in your fermenting process that you actually want to live. So it can sort of be a detriment to the whole process. You can also use people have used iodine, people have used alcohol. You can use isopropyl alcohol or strong grain alcohol, 200 proof grain. Again, this all works, but it's not recommended. It would be fairly expensive to use Everclear or 200 proof grain alcohol to clean everything because you go through a bit of it and it's not cheap. You can also use iodine. That's sort of a messy staining process. We don't really need to do that if you have Be Bright. Another method would be to use hydrogen peroxide. Again, the stronger hydrogen peroxide you buy in bulk is, can get a little expensive, and the weaker stuff you buy in the drugstore is also expensive when you buy enough volume to clean things. So it's, again, it works, but it's so much easier just to get the Be Bright or the other sanitizer. One other method, which the author of the mead making article in this past issue, in our September-October 2013 issue, she uses a grapeseed extract, which is a completely natural, good way to clean them. It's not, it may not be quite as effective as the commercial sanitizers, but it is almost as effective, and it's not that expensive, and it can be used for other purposes. Grapeseed extract, or GSE, there's a couple of different companies that sell it, the health food store, the co-ops. That can be used. It's totally natural and material that does a great job of sanitizing everything. So that's, that might be a good recommendation for people who don't want to spend a lot of money or don't want to go with a commercial agent for cleaning things. So, we can, if they don't want to get the Be Bright, they can go with the grapeseed extract, which is, a lot less expensive. So I'll go through the steps, I think. That's probably okay. Easier that way. The main thing to do is to sanitize the equipment. It's very, very important. No matter how clean it looks to the eye, or no matter how well you think you washed a bottle or washed a carboy or a brewing fermenting bucket, There's still little nooks and crannies or little places in there that maybe you didn't reach and would just be sort of a breeding ground for bad bacteria. And the bacteria is in the air. It's on the surface of the material. I mean, it's not necessarily making us sick, you know, breathing it or anything, but when a food source at a certain temperature touches it, it will thrive. And that eventually, if the colony of bacteria gets so strong, it'll overtake the yeast and it'll kill your whole fermenting process. So with the equipment, including the bottles, the fermenting bucket, the carboys, the tools you use, any spoons you use, the tip of the thermometer, the racking cane, anything like that has to be washed and then rinsed with some type of sanitizer. You know, with the bottles, with the beer bottles or wine bottles, you're going to put your product in. You need to rinse them and turn them upside down, let them drip dry in a dish rack or something. You know, bleach, 1 tablespoon of bleach per gallon is okay for sanitizing it. But again, you know, I personally wouldn't use bleach. I use B-Bright. For those who don't want to use B-Bright, which has its own instructions as far as how much of the powder to put into, it's a powdered cleaning agent, how much to put into a gallon of water. They'll have the instructions on the bottle. If you're using grapeseed extract, we use about 30 drops of grapeseed extract or GSE in 5 gallons of hot water, and that's a good sanitizer. But everything has to be hygienic, and I really can't stress that enough, because at any one point through the process, if something's dirty, even if it doesn't look dirty, it can spoil your fermentation. So that's important. The airlock is, again, that's also important. The presence of air during the fermenting process it'll just turn your wine or your meat into vinegar. So you just really don't want air in there. You want that fermenting action to create carbon dioxide and just make so much of it that it has to release, and the only way it can release is through the airlock. The airlock tube is about the size of a pencil, the tube that you'd stick in the lid of the fermenting bucket. The bucket's sealed with a lid, and the airlock goes in through a little cork, and that the whole tube where the air comes out is probably no thicker than a pencil. So it just burps every once in a while, goes through the liquid water, or some people put vodka in there just to make sure it's a sterilization extra step. Really, it doesn't really matter what you use as long as it's liquid. And so the carbon dioxide will bubble up and pass through the airlock and safely exit into the atmosphere and not let the air back in. So that's that's important. What else you'll need is the temperature. That's an important aspect of the whole thing. If you've got clean equipment and you've got your airlock and everything sealed, you'll need to maintain the fermenting solution. It's called, when you make wine, it's called a must, M-U-S-T. In beer talk, there's another another word for it, but I'm just going to call it, fermenting liquid or whatever. That occurs at around 70 degrees. It's not, it's not always that critical. In some cases, if you don't have a place to make it where you're going to have a consistency, is nice to have it. It's nice to have it at around 70 degrees. But I have known people in beer and wine making and meat making that they can range, you can range from 50 to 80 degrees and trying to avoid swings in temperature, but it'll still work. If where you have your bucket fermenting is at a place where people go back and forth and maybe the temperature will change, a little bit, it's not going to really hurt it all that much, but it's nice to have a place where it can stay at a consistent temperature for the period of time in which it's going to ferment. Ideally, again, around 70 degrees, but that's not carved in stone. When you get up into the close to 80 degrees Fahrenheit, it's getting a little warm. And if you get down to below 60, it's getting a little cool. It's just going to slow it down. It's not going to kill it until it gets, you know, further below that. But again, around 70 degrees is a good temperature range to be in. You know, it needs to cook for a while. It needs to not cook, but it needs to ferment for a while. And you want it to ferment sort of consistently. So you know, try to aim for a place where it's not going to be swinging in temperature too much. The other thing that's important besides temperature is time. You know, you're going to be, in this case, you know, in most cases, people traditionally has been a harvest time beverage. What you're doing, as I said, is to harvest your fruits, your grapes, anything else we're harvesting, and you're going to use them to eat, obviously, make pies with or juices or whatever, and then you're going to, in some cases, put them up in jams, maybe jellies, jams, just putting up the fruits somehow, canning, whatever. But then the excess, you know, always has been to turn into a wine or a mead, and so all this stuff is always done at harvest time. So we're talking anytime really in September, October for most people. So it's put together in the fall, and it and traditionally has been fermented for a long time, 6 to 9 months in some cases, and then at the end of that period, you know, spring, summer, bottling time. But we can speed things up for our processes by just letting it work as long as we want it to work. You know, a few weeks or up into a month and a half maybe, and then we can see what it's like after that time is fermenting time has happened, see what it tastes like. It really if it hasn't gone bad, it's going to be drinkable. It's going to be a better tasting product if you let it work longer, but perfectly good beverages have been made in a period of 6 to 8 weeks. As if people are getting serious about this, they want to try a couple different recipes or try a couple different efforts to see what works. They'll figure out that, you know, time is basically your friend in letting it ferment longer. So we can just think along those lines. But you know, if you want to harvest it and bottle it in a few weeks, then you know we can do that and just see how the taste is, how it works out for you. The other important thing involved is that we've got sanitization, we've got the temperature, we've got the length of time we're going to let it ferment and work, and then the other thing is the water. Water is the second most, probably most critical thing, because just like the sanitization, chlorine in the water is going to work to kill your good bacteria, so, and kill the yeast. So it may not kill all of it, but the even a little bit is not a good thing. You want to let the yeast work. So water is if you want to go out and if you want to filter water, you can do that. Filter it through an activated charcoal filter. If you have a source of spring water that or well water that does not have chlorine in it, that's another good thing. If you have city water and there is chlorine in it, or some kind of processed municipal water where there is chlorine in it, you're going to have to either let the water sit out uncovered in a container for at least a day or so, and let the chlorine it will boil out. You can also boil the water, but that's an energy step you may not want, need to do. Just letting it sit on the counter and letting the chlorine gas off into the atmosphere, and most of it will be removed within 12 to 24 hours. So that's good. I think, you know, for me, I mean, I'm on spring water, or people who have wells are on well water, and there is no chlorine in there. So that should be fine. Good source of water. You could buy it go to the store and buy bottled water, but again, that would be sort of expensive. So for that volume, so you may not want to do that. Basically, we've got all this equipment, and we've got our water, and we've got our sterilization in mind, and what temperatures we're going to work with, and where in the house or pantry or wherever it's going to be in the basement, wherever we have a place to let our product sit for a while undisturbed, and then we just got to think about what we're going to make. The author of this particular article that has recently run here in September is she used pumpkins for her first effort, but for the second effort, apparently it tasted good because the next year she made a raspberry currant wine in 2008. She made an elderberry mead in 2009, a grape mead in 2010, a saffron mead in 2011, and lemon ginger mead in last year. So she tried different styles of wine or mead and used different ingredients. And again, the variants are just going to carry. It's going to be honey based, but you're going to have additives to change the taste into various things like pine and sizers and whatever, grape juice, citrus juices, apples and cider, other fruits. I guess it's melomel is another old traditional drink that's made from honey, and any fruit except for grapes and apples. So there's peaches and any other, a bunch of other stuff you could make. So that's what they call that when it doesn't come from grapes and apples. You've got nepheglin and other herb-based meads, and just a whole bunch of other things, including mixtures of barley and mead, which is called braggot. And a lot of this stuff, it goes way back to the Celtic time, the English Isles, and all the Celtic things going on in Wales and England and Ireland and basically the UK. They had a lot of variants on meads that they were quite famous for, and which you can read about in various places. So, but I think what I was going to do is just stick to one wild grape recipe, because they don't have to be wild grapes, but you can pick the wild grapes and keep the cost down. And I'll just go through that, and it really, really, really quite simple. Just the sort of the step-by-step on it. And I myself, my first wine, it was not mead, but it was wine. Just ended up picking up a bunch of blueberries and just doing it that way, just getting buckets and buckets of blueberries with very high sugar content, fresh off the bush, and just a really decent, stronger than I had anticipated at the outset. I had gotten a very high alcohol tolerant yeast, and it did its job, and it was just even stronger than I really wanted it to be. But it tasted good, a heck of a lot cheaper than buying even box wine at the store. Really good experience, because it you sort of let it work and sort of forget about it until it came time to bottle it, and it worked out quite well. So with the grape piment recipe, and again, piment is a combination of honey and grape, grape juice squeezed from grapes, and water, of course. So you want to get your wild grapes, pick them, stems and all, just pick them off and rinse them off. Now again, they don't have to be wild grapes. If you have a roadside stand where somebody's selling grapes, or if you have a source of grapes on a vine from anywhere, or if you buy, you can buy them at the store if you want to. But just find yourself a source of grapes. And you want to go through there and rinse them first, especially if they're commercial grapes. Make sure you rinse all the pesticides and herbicides off if they're on there, I'm sure they are. Get that all rinsed off, and you want to pluck out all the dried up ones, or the ones that are rotten, or the ones that are obviously damaged, and get them out of there, because one or two really extremely rotten grapes could tend to spoil the batch. And you want to put the grapes, once you rinse them off, put them in a in a container that is not, it's ideal, it's much better to have an enamel type container or a stainless steel. Aluminum really doesn't work well because it can react with the alcohol, and it will acid. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't. We don't want a reaction there, so we want a stainless steel or enamel container that that you can heat, over a flame. So the glass, glass might work if it's the right kind, but if it was just a big glass container, it might, and it wasn't made for cooking, it may well crack. So you sort of want to stick with the enamel or stainless steel pot with a. That you can work with on an open flame. So we've got just putting the grapes and covering them with water to a level of that'll cover up the grapes themselves. You want to bring it to a boil, not to a rolling boil, but just to a boiling point, and then turn the flame off and just let it cool. And you're basically at this point just softening. Softening the skins, getting them ready for your mortar and pestle action here, which is just a clean, empty wine bottle. A good wine bottle or champagne bottle is a champagne bottle has a little bump in the bottom, so that may not always be the best choice. But a heavy enough bottle, you can use it as a masher. Now, some people have wooden, things that you can. You can mash it with, but they have to be sanitized. A wine bottle also has to be clean, but that's easier to do because it's glass. Basically, right in the pot, once the water has cooled, you want to just mash the grapes into it and make a juice out of it. And you just keep on crushing the skins and all. There's going to be stems in there. I mean, obviously, you don't need to really pick all the stems out. They'll be in there because they'll get strained out later. You just want to squish down all those grapes and just crush everything and then pour off the juice, and what's left. I mean, ideally, the more you can crush them, the more juice you're going to get out of the pulp. But at the end, you can always compost the pulp after the juice has been squeezed out of it, so it's not going to go to waste. Again, you with experience, you learn this kind of thing. But if you put too much water in, you're going to get a weaker juice, so you have to sort of use your common sense. By covering the grapes up, it's easier to do it less water at first than more, and you can crush with less water. And obviously, in a place where the juice is going to, if it splatters, it's not going to hurt anything. Or your clothes, don't wear a white shirt. you can work with less juice to begin with, and then if you need to add more, you can always do that. But essentially, you're going to be pouring off the grape juice and then straining, composting the pulp that's left behind, squeezing it out, squeezing the pulp out as much as you can to get as much liquid out as you can. So the idea is to gather your materials. Besides the grape, you're going to need a lot of honey too, and this is for beekeepers. And essentially, that's what I didn't mention at first. The woman who wrote this article is a beekeeper. Her and her husband are commercial beekeepers, and they do have a lot of honey available. So if you were to go out and buy the honey, it wouldn't be a cheap proposition, because we're looking for this recipe. We're looking at about minimum of 16 pounds of honey. Which the prices can vary depending on where you live, but 16 to 19 pounds of honey is what the recipe calls for, and so. That can get a little pricey, but again, it's a recipe, so we're just doing what we have to do. So we're looking at I'm going to say 18 pounds of honey, 4 gallons of water, and you're going to need about 4 cups of grapes, the juice from the grapes. So 4 cups of the juice, 4 cups of grapes. And whatever comes off of that as juice is what we're looking at. And you're going to need a small packet, which is, they come in 5 gram packages. The brand name that I've used before and was mentioned here is called Red Star Pasteur Champagne Yeast, but there's other wine type yeast that will work just as well. It's basically a very common winemaking yeast that will tolerate a higher level of alcohol than your just standard bread, you know, bread yeast. Again, you know, they come in different names, but this particular one's called Red Star Pasteur Champagne yeast. So to go over it again, 18 pounds of honey, 4 gallons of water, 5 grams of Red Star Pasteur Champagne yeast, and about 4 cups of wild grapes, which turn into juice once you've crushed them and put in water in and crushed them. So you want to take 1 gallon of water and heat it in a large pot, and don't boil it, just heat it so it's warm, or you know, below boiling, and remove from the heat and add half of the honey and dissolve it into the water. Now the reason we don't boil the water is because honey really is a lot more there's a lot more nutrition and a lot more value to the honey if it is not boiled. I mean, when they commercially process honey for, you know, grocery store honey, bottled honey, they boil it and they do all sorts of cleansing things to it, and it's really not, that removes a lot of the value of the honey as far as nutritional and medicinal value. So you do not want that water you're putting the honey into to be boiled. You just want it to be hot but not boiling. Enough to melt the honey down into it. So you want to put about half or maybe 9 pounds of honey into the 1 gallon of water that's been heated, and then dissolve. Stir it in there until it's dissolved, and then you want to pour that dissolved honey and water mixture into the big fermenting bucket. And the big fermenting bucket is called the primary bucket or primary fermenter, and that's a container, a food grade container with a lid, and in the lid there's going to be the airlock that I mentioned before. So you have that in the fermenter now, and then you want to stir in the remaining 9 pounds of honey, and stir that in, and the water will still be warm. So let that blend in. You've already processed the first 9 pounds. Now you want to add the remainder of the honey and blend it in. And now you want to put in the wild grape or the grape juice that you've crushed from the grapes. So now we've got pretty much all the stuff we've, the main ingredients, the honey and the grape juice and the water that's been sanitized, make sure that has been, the chlorine's been removed from it, or it's water that comes from a source where no chlorine has been used. At this point, you're ready to put in your remaining water, which is we started with 4 gallons of water, so now we're going to put in the remaining 3 gallons of water, which is going to be having set in the room for a while. It's going to be at room temperature. You don't really want to put in cold water. It should be at room temperature, which, you know, is fine at whatever, you know, 65 degrees, whatever it is, 70 degrees. And then you stir it in. So we've got everything now in the fermenting bucket. At this point, you know, people who do this for a hobby, at this point they take a hydrometer and they measure the alcohol. They take a hydrometer reading at this point. A hydrometer is a device that measures the level of alcohol in a solution. So there's a way to calculate if you know what you start with and you know what you finish with, then we can establish what the conversion levels are and how much alcohol is in the beverage. It's not a necessary step for beginners, so you know, I'm just mentioning it now. This is the point at which to do it, but you don't need to do that. But you will need to measure the temperature of the mixture in the primary fermenter, and that will be on a dial thermometer. That's going to show up at about 60. You want it to be somewhere between 60 and 70 degrees, or you know, just a reasonable room temperature. Now the stuff is ready. Now at this point, the lid is off the fermenter, and so it's exposed to the air. You've got 4 gallons of this juice in there. And you're preparing to ferment it. Fermenting it means adding yeast. And so what you do is you take your yeast and you generally the instructions on the yeast will tell you to rehydrate it or basically introduce it to a warm water source to get the yeast back up and thriving again. So most of them will say you take about a cup of water and you heat that to somewhere between 80 and 100 degrees, and that's, you know, it depends on the manufacturer, whatever the instructions will be on the packet, or if you buy it at a store, you might want to ask the individual what the best temperatures are, but it'll be somewhere between 80 and 100 degrees. Cup of water. You will mix in your yeast into this warm water and let it sit for about 10 or 15 minutes to let it activate and start to work and get everything woken up and get it ready to go. And then after about 10, 15 minutes, you'll want to slowly stir this pure yeast mixture into your about-to-be-fermented 4 gallons of grape and honey warm water mixture. And again, I say this is a mixture that is sitting at about 65 degrees, somewhere between 60 and 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So you want the yeast to be poured into the primary fermenter at about, you know, 65, 70 degrees, and you stir it and gently stir it and just let the yeast blend in carefully or cautiously into the liquid in the fermenter, and make sure everything's clean. If you're going to stir it with a spoon, it really has to be make sure that spoon has been sanitized. Most people use a stainless steel long-handled ladle or spoon that can be easily cleaned and dries quickly and all that kind of thing. So you want to stir it and get everything well stirred up anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes. You don't really need to go any longer than that, but it shouldn't just be poured in and left. It definitely and absolutely needs to be stirred for at least a few minutes. And then at that point, you're ready to put the lid on the bucket and close off the fermenting container so that no further air can get into it. So at this point, we have the bucket with the water, the honey, the yeast, and the grape juice in there. It's at about 65 or 70 degrees. We're putting the lid on it. The airlock is filled with water and sealed, and the airlock is in the lid, so everything is all buttoned up. And we'll want, this fermentation will occur now, it gives some time. This whole bucket, you can move the bucket around as you need to. At the beginning stages, it shouldn't really hurt anything at all. You got to put it in a place where we're talking about temperatures between 60 and 75 degrees, for example, where you can just let it sit and work without disturbing it, out of the way. You know, you can check on it every once in a while, but it will just sit there, and you know, especially for new people who haven't done this before, they think it's failed or whatever if nothing happens. But within a few days and maybe even up to a week, you'll start to notice bubbling. Now, absolutely, do not lift the lid up. If you can't see it or hear it bubbling, do not lift the lid up to see if it's working. It will. If you've cleaned everything, it will work, and if the temperatures are right, it will work. If your water has been not chlorinated, it will do something. So after about 3 days, maybe 5 days, the bubbles will start to burp out of there. It won't be a violent bubbling at first. It'll just be a little bit of small bubbles, and then it'll burp once in a while, and then at some point, between a week. Well, after that first week, it's going to start bubbling more obviously, and it will continue to bubble. And it'll bubble for about 3 weeks, maybe 2 to 3 weeks. And so that means that, you know, most of the yeast has consumed its sugars, and everything is, you know, is working well. But again, we do not open the lid at all until this bubbling process has stopped. Now, you know, I'm just going to say these time frames are really dependent upon how much honey you put in, what the temperatures of the water were, what you're using for your fruit, All these things change the time frame, but I'm going to say after about 3 weeks, the bubbling should have slowed down, and at this point we're going to rack the mead or basically transfer it from the primary fermenting container to the carboy where it's going to sit for its weeks on end. So essentially we have to make sure that carboy, which is, by the way, which is just a big, a huge bottle, it's a 5 gallon, or some are 6 gallons, some are five. They have a narrow neck and a big body on it. It looks like a big water cooler, glass water cooler container, the kind you see upside down in the old-fashioned water coolers that the offices have. So basically, we need to sanitize the carboy and then take your racking cane, which is, again, that tube, that long tube that you're going to drain the fermented liquid out of and put it into the carboy. This tube is called a racking cane, and that has to also be sanitized. It's basically a siphon, and so you stick the carboy or the empty container on the floor, and you put the fermenting or leave the fermenting container on the counter, and then you make sure you have the hose and the racking cane sanitized, and you fill the racking cane with clean water and the tube, so that means the air has been driven out of it, and you dump the you poke the racking cane into the fermenter down towards the bottom of the thing, but not it doesn't need to go all the way to the bottom, but it shouldn't be at the top, it should be down towards the bottom, and then you will lower the hose end of the racking cane down towards the carboy. But it's a good idea to have a little bucket down there, because that first squirt is going to be all liquid and a little bit of mead. So what you want to do is just drain that, get rid of that sort of dissolved water and mead mix into the little bucket first, and then once it's flowing with pure mead or fermented mead, you want to then transfer it or just aim the hose into the carboy and let it drain into there. You just basically want to end. You want to make sure that the sucking end of the racking cane is well into the fermenting bucket, and you want to be sure the hose end is down well below the bottom of the fermenter into the carboy, so that transfer of liquid is complete. If it's important to keep the end of the racking cane or the sucking part just a little bit above the base of the fermenting thing, because you don't need to be sucking up all that spent yeast and sediment and all this stuff, because that you really want it as clear as possible. So you want to leave that stuff behind. So the more you can leave behind at first, the better. So you fill up the carboy to the top, right up to the neck with the liquid. If you need to adjust that, you can add clean water. No chlorinated water, just clean water to adjust. If you're up near the neck and you need to bring it to the neck, you just add, you might need a pint of water or a cup of water, whatever it takes, to top it off. And then you install a fermentation lock on the carboy container. Again, the fermentation lock is going to have water or some type of liquid like vodka or something to seal it. And that's about it. I mean, this solution is going to work for anywhere from 6 weeks to 9 months, and it is going to bubble in that time. No matter how long take to do it, it's going to bubble. And sometimes it bubbles and then it stops bubbling, and you think, oh, it's finished working. And then lo and behold, for whatever reason, temperature change maybe, or just activity, or it'll start bubbling again. Nothing violent. It'll just make a little bubbles, and that's fine. Just let it do its thing. But after a period of time, which I think can be a few weeks to 9 months, depending on how long you choose to let it work, you're ready to bottle it. And again, the bottles that you're going to put it in, the smaller bottles, have got to be clean. And you're going to do the same process, same siphoning process that you did with the transferring it from the fermenting bucket to the carboy. Just take that racking cane and the siphon tube and just siphon the juice from the big carboy container down into each individual bottle. Now this becomes a little messier. So what you probably want to do, especially if you're in a place where you're not just going to be outside somewhere, you're in. I have a little pantry I use with a linoleum type floor that's easily cleaned up. But I still take a little tub like a dish pan or something like that, and put the bottles in there. Just lay your clean bottles in there, neck up, and then you can, as you transfer from bottle to bottle, you're going to have a little overflow. So it doesn't matter; it just goes into the dish pan, and just fill each individual bottle, and then you can just cap them or cork them. I mean, I say cap because I'm more of a beer maker, but you cork them with you can buy sanitized corks, or you can. It's not that easy to reuse corks. You can do that, but especially the synthetic ones. But if these new corks are very cheap at the home brewer supply and winemaker, so you can use them, and you'll just cork off each individual bottle, and there you go. And they can be stored on their sides to make sure the cork is wet, and that'll help seal. And they will last like that for quite a while. To put a point on it, even the after it's bottled, they will still work in the bottle just like wine does over time. So it'll keep. Most people drink it fairly quickly after they've bottled it, but you can hold on to it for quite a while, and that's essentially the point, isn't it? We talked about that being the whole reason we're just taking our fruit and turning it into a product that has enough alcohol in it that it will keep it to store it for, so we can drink it months or even years later. The level of alcohol in these beverages is going to be anywhere from 8% to if you've made an extremely high alcohol level of wine, it might be up in the 14% range. That's not usual for most beginners, but we can look at a wine somewhere between really realistically between about 5.5% and maybe up to 12% alcohol. And it'll taste, because the honey's in there, it's going to taste really good. And if you add the additional grape, in this recipe we did add the grape juice, so it'll have that grape flavor as well. But, you can imagine this, a sweet honey wine product being infused with, tastes of herbs and spices and peach or grape or, any apple. I mean, anything you want to put into it, that's what it's going to take on the flavor of, because that's the juice that's going to be mixed with it. So the only other thing which I really didn't discuss was in the transferring step, you can always go through, strain it through cheesecloth. We talked about cheesecloth in the beginning. Strain it through cheesecloth and just get the last bit of that sediment out. And, of course, in the carboy, what didn't settle out in the fermenting bucket is going to settle out in the carboy. And then as you put it through the straining process, you're going to get additional out. So, honestly, you're still going to have a little bit of sediment, mostly for most people in the bottles as well. So, just when you pour the bottled wine into a glass, you just do it carefully so that the sediment stays in the bottle and doesn't go into your drink, and you'll end up with a pretty clear product, which beer makers and such, winemakers aren't really that disturbed by sediment, but maybe other people might be, so you just want to keep it looking good when it's in the bottle, or in the glass, so you can use the cheesecloth to get that out. But, again, this is, if you started today, if you went and bought all your stuff today or started making meat tomorrow, you'd have a drinkable product by Christmas time or by the celebration of the holidays starting early December. If you wanted to wait for a long time and maybe have it in the summertime, that would be probably a better tasting product, but, it's up to you, or any time in between. You could make it, drink some of it in the holidays, and then save some of it for those cold February nights and, have it for dinner or by the fire or whatever. But it's, it's an excellent product, and with the honey in it, it really has some, unusual taste to it and some sweetness, and and you know, medicinal value as well. So that's a lot of what this was used for in the old days. You know, with all the bronchial and chest related diseases and things that were going on, probably those olden times, those cold buildings and drafts and everything. This was not just a luxury; it was a necessity in many cases. So, you know, historically, mead's been a very important part of our heritage.
Awesome. Now, the use of you know, cause my understanding is that honey is the only food that doesn't have a heat source. I mean, not heat, a expiration date. Is that correct?
Yeah, honey. You know, I keep bees, and I associate with people that have kept bees a lot longer than I have, and I talk to them, and a couple of people in particular. They apparently, archaeologists and people like that have apparently found stored honey from the time of the pyramids. You know, I'm not sure what dates those are, but that's easily figured out. But there's actually honey that is edible. Honey has been discovered in pyramid diggings or whatever, archaeological excavations, that has been re-warmed and eaten, and that's how old it is, and it's still edible. So yeah, honey's about the only thing that really does not go bad, as long as it's stored, you know, sealed and stored properly. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, I made the mistake I had some honey that ended up being crystallized, and I was, because our farmhouse, you know, we've got propane heaters in the two bedrooms, the living room, and that's pretty much it. And so the hallway is just whatever it gets, you know, built in 1900. There's not a whole lot of insulation. And we had some honey just sitting in the kitchen. They got crystallized. And I just thought from growing up, whenever that happened, Dad always, don't put the honey in the refrigerator and all this kind of stuff, and that it would just, it's ruined at that point. But no, I understand. I was quickly reminded. I think it may have been when you were on the show talking about it that no, that's not the case. You can just warm it back up, heat it back up, and everything will be fine and dandy and whatnot. But I also have learned that it supposedly is the only food without an expiration date, which is amazing. So I've got about, I think, 2 gallons of honey that I purchased for my 30-year kind of supply thing to use honey for sweetened things, or some of the number 10 cans and things like that I have if I needed to use it as a sweetener. And they, a lot of people claim it's got the first aid value as well and whatnot. So I think we've got a gallon. And I honestly haven't looked at it in at least 2 years. It's in the hallway with some other items and where it gets quite cold. So it may have been crystallized as well, but I'll have to open it up and check it. But I know every, like I said, every time we get together with my niece, she's always talking about making mead. And so when you mentioned it, I immediately knew what it was. Didn't know, I guess, all the technical things about it, how to make it myself or anything like that. But she's made it. She's brought some and shared with the family members that do partake in that. So I knew at least what it was. And when I posted about it, a lot of people liked the topic and knew that it was knew what it was. And some of the people have made it before, too. So. But no, that's all really good information. I like the fact that you talked about, you know, relating it to, or some of this to back to, you know, the Bible times, Genesis, and things like that, and how long a lot of this has been around. It's, you know, nothing new. And I learned something else today. I had no idea that you had incarcerated subscribers.
Yeah, that's very, you know, people don't think about that, but we do get regular letters from people, you know, in prison, and we have to go through certain steps to deal with them because they have rules and regulations, and you know, we don't mind doing that, but a lot of prisons will not allow anything to come in anything but a first class package, so we have to make all, you know, arrangements for that. And and I spoke before about certain things in there, like any knife making, any alcoholic beverage, any you know, that kind of thing. You know, anything that can be used as a weapon or anything odd. And there's a whole laundry list of things that we get. You know, literally, there's a sheet with probably a dozen or two dozen little boxes. You know, check boxes that all the things that are contraband are not allowed. And when you get the letter back from the warden that says, why the magazine was not delivered. It'll have one or two things checked, and so they, apparently they go through the mail and they read the magazine and they make sure that it's not getting into the wrong hands. So, but yeah, I mean, I guess that's you know, it's good. I guess there's not a whole lot of other stuff to do but read, you know.
All right. You're right, exactly. And then maybe make some in the commode, which we I saw firsthand in several occasions, and I was like, seriously? I just, you know, one of those things. You never ingest some of the, totally off topic, but some of the, I guess, just plain and fashion ingenious weapons that were made and adapt and overcome and compromise and getting around things, or and even having your own still, if you will, in your cell by using the toilet and fruit left over from breakfast to lunch and dinner. So it's pretty cool. So going back, I guess this show really talks about going back to the basics, since we've talked about things happening, you know, 2,000 year plus years ago, and back to the pyramids with the honey and things like that. So that is really cool information. I don't have it right in front of me, or maybe actually I do. Just a second, I'm going to see when you come back here in a couple of weeks what the topic might be. Let me scroll down here and see if we have it on the list. Yeah, October 10th, we've got stocking up. Let me put my glasses on. I'm getting old here, Richard. Stocking up the living 3-month pantry. Now, maybe you can elaborate on, because I talked about that when I had, on an earlier episode, I had named all of these topics for people to look forward to. Stocking up the living 3-month pantry. So would that have to do anything with, if I read it, so you'll know what the layman might think of, is the living 3-month pantry, like maybe having 3 months of seed storage, or three months of feed on your property, that you'll have 3 months of nutrition just with what's growing, or 3 months of using sprouts or wheatgrass?
No.
or am I totally off topic?
It's mainly, no, that would make sense, but that's not, it's really more like rotational use of the food in there. So it's not, you're actually using and then replenishing the food that you're eating out of, because the thing is, with a lot of food storage, is people think, they don't think ahead, and they think, oh, okay, I'm just going to store stuff that stores well, and then if they ever had to come to use it, it's like, I don't like this, or, you know, I didn't realize it tastes like that, or not because the food's bad, but because they didn't make good choices in their selection. They didn't plan their menus out correctly, they didn't think about what they really want to eat, they didn't vary anything. So the only way to really, or one of the ways to really make sure that it happens correctly, is to actually eat from the storage source and replenish it, so that you are eating, and then you'll learn from experience. You know, this menu wasn't the favorite one. We need to work on that, so you can sort of fine tune your food choices. And so by eating out of the pantry and replenishing it as you go, you can sort of develop a sense of taste and what appeals to people, you know, especially with kids or whatever. You know, they may be picky eaters and they really don't want, you know, they don't want every meal to be something they don't like. So it's a good idea to plan ahead and sort of include foods in the storage plan that people actually like, in addition to being nutritious and you know.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that from some folks who've talked about the Prepper Penny and some others, and talking about that, and I'm guilty of that. I don't rotate. Of course, we're on the road a lot now, almost I consider full-time on the road, though we still have the homestead, and to where we've bought the tried to look at buying the 30-year storage for the what-ifs and the preparedness and things. And we don't rotate, and then that is recommended. You're bringing a point up that many of the experts have shared with us, and I'm not guilty of doing that. You know, we bought all this 30-year stuff. It's there, and I've also heard some things about that we're doing a no-no, because people will buy wheat berries and things like that, and they'll get a hand cranked, and just they can't physically do it. That is, it surprises them as to how hard it is versus a powered one. And then, of course, if you don't have power, you're going to have to use a hand crank. And how, if you all of a sudden, I've seen nutritionalists talk about, if all of a sudden you're now eating this freeze-dried, this dehydrated, this food, and maybe using now raw wheat berries and things like that, that it could have some negative consequences on your digestive system as well. If you don't kind of get used to it, incorporate it, slowly get, all of a sudden you're now eating this completely, totally different diet, how it can have negative effects on your health and your system as well. So, okay, so that makes sense. So, you know, guys, when I think about that, the first thing that comes to mind is having one of these huge industrial shelves where I take a can and the next can rolls forward. And then I buy, when I go to Walmart, 2 cans instead of having to buy 300 cans. I just buy it every week, add to that, and it rolls through and I'm using it. Or I'm using the number 10 can of this, that, or the other, and then kind of replenishing that or using at least some of it, incorporating some of it into our weekly rations. And if we were at the homestead full time, that is something I feel like we should have to do. Now, we've occasionally opened this, that, or the other to try it out before we bought, but you can't do that with everything because then it doesn't have that 30-year shelf life. Okay, so again, I had you on, and I wanted to look at the next topic on the 10th, and I would be able to share with folks what exactly that meant. I interpret it wrong, which probably is pretty common on an average day. thank you very much for coming on. Great information. I'm sure we'll get a lot of archive listeners on this because I've come across several people that know about mead or make mead and or want to learn about it and how to do it. So thank you very much for coming on and sharing this information. And I think later this week, I didn't have a chance to, I think last episode you were on, I meant to, we just might, for our listeners, might be giving away a 1-year subscription to your magazine, Back Home Magazine. And of course, folks, you can go online, backhomemagazine.com, and you can order right there online, or you can even call them and talk to a real person right there in North Carolina that's going to be able to set you up with your order. But we're about due to give away a 1-year subscription here, probably on our Facebook page, and get your great publication in more readers' hands. I know you have I've been doing this well over 20 years, and so if somebody wanted to have every magazine you've ever published, they can do that and use it as kind of we've talked about it, using kind of an encyclopedia reference guide to homestead living. So, Richard, thank you very much for joining us today. As always, it's awesome when you're on, and we look forward to it. Christmas Chick in the chat room says she loves hers. She actually won one of your subscriptions, and she loves to get hers every other month. So, but we appreciate you coming on. We look forward to having you back on the 10th of October.
Okay, we'll talk about food in the living pantry then at that point. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Sounds awesome. Thank you much for joining us. Bye-bye. All righty, very cool. I love it when Richard's on, and I just learned so much, and y'all learned so much, and I hear from y'all that you love the show, all the homesteaders out there, and even the city dwellers can learn so much just about daily life, maybe making your life simpler or anything, getting back to nature and things like that. So I got to love it when Richard's on. So we appreciate him coming on. BackHomeMagazine.com is where you can subscribe. You love it when he's on the second, fourth Thursday of every month. You'll love his publication. So, hey, we hope you have a wonderful weekend this weekend. This is going to wrap it up this week with Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We will return this coming Monday, as always, with Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown, founder of FirstStateVetSupply.com. And we hope that you'll join us then next week, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on Blog Talk Radio. God bless everybody. Oh.